First of all, before we start tonight's subject, I'd like to speak about something that we began before and to continue an element of something that we looked at before and look at more depth. But I feel obliged to say before we begin that what we're about to speak about tonight is not the most important subject that people need for now. What a person needs now in Elul, this month before Rosh Hashanah, what a person needs more than anything else is the details of how to put into practice the mitzvah of tshuva. That means how to fix up what a person's done wrong in their neshamas, in their own personalities, in their interpersonal relationships, the damage that they've done in their own lives, done to the world, in the cosmic system, in the personal system. And therefore, that's much more important than this. And therefore, but since there are many people here who've been through that discussion that we together, we've had that discussion together more than once, I wouldn't like to do that when there are people who may not wish to hear it a second or third or fourth time. And therefore, we'll discuss something else. But I'd like it to be known that we are starting a shiur on that subject. It's at the Osamach address in Sandton. Tomorrow night is due to be the first of a series where we'll start the Rambam's Hilchos Tshuva from the beginning. We've been doing that on Sunday nights also, but we began that section more than a year ago, or about a year ago. So, again, the current mitzvah that a person needs is this issue. And that will be in view of the fact that that's what we need to know for my revision and for those who want to do it with me. We'll be doing that in Sandton, and you're not responsible to be there. I'm just telling you that for those who feel a need to revise that subject and are perhaps not capable of doing it themselves or don't know where to get hold of the English translations or whatever it is, so then that's where that will be done. Perhaps it'll be recorded. You can get recordings if you can't come. But that is the work of this time of year. Perhaps we'll discuss some aspects of it as we get closer to Rosh Hashanah. Now, tonight's subject is a difficult thing. Don't have any seats? Can't find a seat? Maybe some of these men could pass one or two empty seats to the back, if possible, so that people can sit down. Thank you. Another one, someplace? Another seat? Thank you. Now, the subject we were speaking about for a while was the subject of Rebbe and Talmud, the nature of a Torah teacher and how to relate to a Torah teacher and the different kinds, different modes in which Torah teaching can take place. Who was not here for that discussion? The thing about this discussion is that I would feel it's necessary to say that you'll get much more out of the discussion if you have, the more Torah background you have, or the more Jewish history you're aware of in Torah terms, the more that one could get out of this discussion. If you're a newcomer to these things, then the mystical side of things and the Jewish history side, then this would serve as an introduction, but a person may have to go over this many times, and they may have to fill it in from many angles before it will really become meaningful. But let's see what we can grasp. We said this. Let's try and pick up where we left off and see if we can explore this dimension of Torah teaching in depth. Among other things that we described when we spoke about what a Torah teacher is, a master and his relationship with his disciple, Rebbe and Talmud, we said that one unique feature of the Torah teaching personality or the Torah personality is that you see that the men, people who teach Torah, the greatest of them often can be put into one or two categories, and that is the Rebbe who teaches with softness and gentleness and the Rebbe who teaches with fire. You can see it even today, and I think I pointed out examples. Some of us even sitting here have experience with teachers who are so fiery or frightening in every sense that it might take a long time to gather the courage even to speak to them. And there are some Torah teachers who are so self-effacing that a person wouldn't even realize that they were people of greatness or that they had any power to their personality unless one had a very close and intimate association with them. Many examples. In the last generation, perhaps two of the best known were the Briskerov and Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. It was well known that Rav Issa Zalman, if anyone said in front of him anything that wasn't right, if somebody said a Torah idea in front of him that wasn't accurate, in fact, if it was blatantly wrong, he would nod sort of understandingly and say, yes, yes, what you probably mean is, and then he would sort of explain the correct version of what the person was trying to say without embarrassing the person at all, without the person even realizing that he would be corrected. The Brisker Rebbe lived in the same, was a contemporary, or lived in the same period of time. If a person said an idea in front of the Brisker Rebbe that wasn't accurate, that wasn't Torah accurate, he would start to shake with such violence that they had to remove the person from the room. In other words, you have these two. There was also, one also has to understand, that there's also the issue that a person has to understand. We're just trying to set the scene, and then we'll try and investigate the depth from which this comes. There's also the issue of a Torah teacher being gentle, but when the honor of Torah is at stake, then he has to be very, very sharp. Because it's not his personal honor that's at stake, it's the kavod haTorah. When people stand up for a Rebbe, for somebody who represents Torah, they're not standing up for the personal greatness of the individual, they're standing up for the Torah that he represents. Otherwise one would have to make careful distinctions about whom one honours in which kind of way. But what we understand in the Torah world is that if a person represents Torah teaching, even though, of course, he may not be having the greatness to generate it himself, he may just be recording, a tape recording basically, of what he learned from his Rebbe or Rebbeim, but nevertheless one stands up for the Kavod HaTorah. There were certain rabbis of the last generation who used to remind themselves of this fact when they walked through a great community and everyone would stand up for them, in order to remind themselves that it wasn't his own personal being that was being honored, and in order not to get trapped in the feeling of pride that he can generate, he would carry always a chumash with him. So that as he walked down the aisle of his shul or whatever it was and everyone stood up, he would be cognizant of the fact that it was because he was holding Torah close to him, they were standing up for the book and not for him. But it means that the Torah in a person has to be honored. And there were many great Torah teachers who evinced this personality. Rabbi Kiva Eger, for example. Rabbi Kiva Eger lived before the generation of the people we just described, was a man who was very self-effacing and almost never stood on his honor. But when the honor of Torah was at stake, he certainly had he packed a punch, let's say, in Torah terms, that was frightening. I mean, on one occasion a man refused to give his wife a divorce, which he was obliged to give in halacha, but he refused to give it. And there was nothing the community could do or the Beis Din could do. So finally they brought the man to Rabbi Kiva Eger. So the man entered Rabbi Kiva Eger's house, he stood in front of him, and Rabbi Kiva just said to him the following words. He just quoted the Mishnah about how a woman is released from marriage, that's all. He said, Aisha Yotzeis, a woman goes out, per get or per mitzvas habal, with a divorce or with the death of the husband. There's only two ways. He said to him clearly, divorce or death of the husband. So the man was recalcitrant, refused, you're not going to give it. So he quietly repeated the words again. The woman goes out, Isha Yotzeis, beget over Mrs. Habal. The man turned around and walked out and dropped dead on the front steps of the house. When he had to do that kind of thing, he did it. And when he had to apply that sort of strength and power to Torah teaching, you might find that a little strange. If you've ever been associated with anybody who has that kind of power, as I have, anybody else may have seen, then you won't need explanations or convincing to see the kind of fire that can emanate from people who generate the level, right, that can do such things. Now, not to say there's not power in the gentle Torah personality. I think I've illustrated here before occasions on which I personally, in my own humble beginner status, have spoken to people of Torah greatness who manifest the gentle side, and I've seen things just as wonderful. Not things of sharpness, but things of insight into what a person may be thinking or the way a situation is, even though it hasn't been explained to them with absolute clarity and accuracy and insight. Now, the power, I'm not talking about how greatness or power here, we're simply talking about the mode in which it manifests. Now, this idea needs examination. First of all, there's a problem. The problem is that there is a chazal, a statement in the sages that says that there is a way for a Torah teacher to be, and he should always be the humble side, the quiet, self-effacing type, and it shouldn't be the other way. That will need understanding, because how is it that we see Torah teachers who aren't that way? How is it that we see some men of greatness of this generation or the last generation who conducted themselves with such regal, royal authority that they didn't seem to be behaving in the self-effacing way? It says, La'olam yehei adam anbasan kehillel. A person should always be self-effacing and humble and modest like Hillel was, and not strong and demanding and strict like Shammai was. We'll discuss this in more detail. position. So how was it that there were Torah teachers who exemplified the way, the derech, the path of strictness when it's a clear instruction from? So probably the way to resolve that, I heard from a very great man, is that it doesn't mean a person must choose that personality if he already has the other. It means if a person's in doubt in which way to conduct himself, he should conduct himself like Hillel. But if he's not in doubt, in other words, if his Torah teaching mode, if the way his personality manifests is the side of sharpness and fire, and he's on the level to be able to do that, of course, it's a much harder level to maintain. Because if a person wants to maintain the fiery, disciplined aspect of Torah, you must be perfect. If you're self-effacing and you make nothing and you make little of yourself, so then mistakes can be tolerated. But if you're a person who generates fire, so it's very embarrassing to make mistakes. A person cannot do that unless he really is that. There's no way to pretend. A person can't. You see, when a person is self-effacing and modest, you don't know if he's just humble or if he's just right. You don't know if he says he's a nobody and he's being humble, or if he just is a nobody and he's just being truthful. One doesn't know. But with a person who's fiery and demanding of himself and of others, he must live up to that level of perfection. And therefore, somebody who is on that level and does live up to it, so that person manifests that personality. But a young person starting out who wants to know, who's not decided yet, who does not have a clear-cut form or application of personality, he should decide to be on the humble or modest or self-effacing side. And that explains how there could be people who conducted themselves in their Torah conduct in that way of royalty. I once heard from a man in Shalom who said he could tell the story because he was a descendant of this particular individual. This particular man, whom I know, if anyone has ever seen him, will know represents fully the line of fire. And once when discussing this subject, he spoke about one of his ancestors, who lived in the last century, who was known as the Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi was a man of unbelievable fire and sharpness. So fiery that people of that generation, who were very demanding of their Torah teachers, very demanding, there were cases, there's a case in Eastern Europe of a man, of a Rebbe in a town, who was discharged of his obligations, or a genius of a man, who was discharged of his position in a town, because he was so poor, that he didn't have candles to last through the night. So he, instead of sitting up and learning all night by candlelight, he has to learn by heart. When he couldn't afford candlelight anymore, he used to sit and learn through the night, by heart, didn't bother him, learn by heart. The community fired him, because they didn't see a light in his window all night. That means the Torah community, the Eastern European town, was on such a level that if the Rebbe wasn't up all night, every night learning Torah, he wasn't worthy of being called the Rebbe. So the community, the level of the community, the level of course, the level of a Rebbe is only as great as his Talmidim. Moshe Rabbeinu had to fall when his students fell, when the Jewish people fell, when they rose, he rose. He's only a function of the people. But in that level of demanding, where people demanded of their teachers that they should be close to perfection and make tremendous demands upon themselves and upon their students. So even in that generation, the Chacham Tzvi was so great and he was so fiery that people sometimes couldn't get on with him. And there's a story that I heard from one of his descendants, that it happened that the Chacham Tzvi once actually had to leave a certain town where he was the Rav of a big town in Europe because he was too strict, he was too difficult for the people to get on with, and he left. Where did he go? He moved into the house of a simple Jew. This is what he did. An absolutely royal, regal authority. He moved into the house of a simple Jew. Simple, ordinary Jew. He moved in. I've come to stay. This man was overawed by the presence of this great individual who stayed in his house, and he spent a long time in this man's house, ordering him around like a slave to do this and to do that, and the man eventually couldn't take it. Eventually, after a lengthy period of serving this man in royal fashion, eventually it became too much of a strain. And one day he approached the Chacham Tzvi and he said to him, that's a true story, exactly. He approached him and he said to him, Rebbe, I have to ask you this. How long is the Rav still going to be staying? So the Chacham Tzvi said to him, I'll tell you exactly. Next week, a delegation will arrive here from Vienna, asking me to be the Rav of Vienna. And exactly what happened, by the way. A week later, a delegation arrived from Vienna and he became the Rav in Vienna. He predicted the future. In a week's time, a delegation will arrive. They will ask me to be the Rav in Vienna, and I'm staying until then. That's what he told the man. But as for you, that's what he said to him. As for you, because you have served me, and because you have behaved in the way that you have, and you've been my host for this length of time, I'm going to give you a blessing. I'm going to give you a brocha for untold wealth. This blessing will be in your family. Had you not asked me the question that you've just asked me, I would have given you this blessing at Soif Kol HaDoros. That means until the Mashiach. All the generations in your family, you would have had this blessing of wealth. But because you used your poor means to serve me and to host me the way you have, I'm going to give you this blessing for many generations. Not as I would have, because you limited it by asking me when I leave. But that man was the father of the first Rothschild. The father of the first family that rose to great prominence and wealth. That's the story. True story. And he left. A week later they came and then he left. Now, let's try and trace much deeper, in much, much more elevated generations, let's try and trace, according to certain mystical insights that result in his certain of his comments on reincarnation, Gilgulim, how neshamas flow through the generations and appear at different incarnations over the generations. He traces this pathway, he and the Maharal, others, trace this pathway of two different Torah teaching personalities. Let's try and see this idea and see where it comes from. You may not be familiar with all the names, depends on your background, as I said. If you are, you'll see great depth in it. If not, you'll see it as introduction to the subject at least. See how far it goes. Let's try and start with the two. Let's start at the generation that's best known. And then we'll try and trace it backwards to its origins. And then in Yitzhak Shem, we'll try and trace it forwards to its final application. The generation that's best known, that best exemplifies this split of two different types of personality. It's not just Torah teaching personality. Actually, it's two personalities in everything. Is Hillel and Shammai. Anybody here who's not heard of Hillel and Shammai? Hillel and Shammai were the two great teachers of Israel who lived about 100 years before the destruction of the Second Temple, approximately about a century before, which means we're talking now about two centuries approximately before the beginning of the Common Era, about 2,000 years ago. Hillel and Shammai were the two great Torah teachers of the Jewish people. And they exemplified two different personalities. Now that's what we'll have to grasp very strongly, and then we'll be able to trace its roots in the mystical world, in the deepest of mystical levels. It's been explained to us by our teachers. And then we'll be able to see what it means as it follows itself on throughout history. Hillel and Shammai were two people. A lot of difficult things to grasp here. Let's see if we can try and grasp it. The trouble is that we've been used to thinking about these things in terms of childish terms. When the Gemara said that Hillel was very forgiving and Shammai was very strict, so we think he was an angry man. Shammai was an angry person. He didn't tolerate nonsense. And Hillel was a very self-effacing, modest, humble man. We have to understand deeper. Let's try and see this. First of all, who were they? So Shammai, it says, let's start with Shammai. Shammai was the one who was of tremendous discipline. His personality was pure fire. He was exacting to the unbelievable degree. The Mephoshim say that the word Shammai comes from the word Shaith. Try and understand this. Later we'll see the word Hillel, where it comes from. It's an unbelievable thing. But the word Shammai comes from the word Shaith. Shaith means a name. Because a name in the mystical system always is the point of perfection. The word, a name, always indicates, in fact it's very, very amazing, you'll see that if you trace it back in previous generations, in each generation you'll see the same line. Behind them and in front of them you'll see there were two lines, what the Maharal calls the right hand side and the left hand side. The side of kindness and forgiving and the side of strict discipline, unforgiving, as it were. Their teachers followed the same pattern and their students followed the same pattern. The teachers of Shammai and Hillel were Shmaya and Avtalion. Even the name Shmaya is from the same root of shame. Shame means a name. That means his name was a name. You understand? He was so close to perfection. That means he was so living on such a level of demand for perfection that his name is the word we use for a name. The mystical concept of a name is always that which stipulates and expresses the absolute totality of what the thing is. Because a name in Hebrew is always the description of the thing itself. That's why your name is so significant. One's name. Because it's a total description of what you are. Of course, if you think about the word shame meaning a name, you'll see it's got another meaning also. It means sham, which means there. It means there. The mystics say that the word there is the root of the word shamayim, which means heaven, but it doesn't mean heaven. It means the final reality, the next world. Because shamayim, if you put the vowels in differently, it spells shamim, which means all the totality of the theres that you could ever say. In other words, the final endpoint beyond which there's no endpoint. The final total perfection that everything was designed to get to. That's called Sham. And of course that's contained in a name. When the Torah names a thing, it names its essence. As we've given many examples, as we've discussed over the weeks and months. So Shammai, he was a person of such perfection and such demand, that the Gemara says, for example, about him, that the way he operated in the world was this. He was completely geared towards the end point. To understand very well, for people who study any Talmud, Mishnah, Talmud, you'll be fascinated by this, because these are ideas that run as a thread throughout all Talmudic argument, that people who've been working with Talmud for many years often don't appreciate how these things tie together. Shammai, it says, was of a depth that he used to focus everything towards the endpoint. The rest of the world that generates the endpoint, was always by him a fallen reality. It was a reality that needs to be reconstructed to get to the endpoint. Hillel was a person who always started with a reality. He started with a reality that needs reconstructing. That was his reality, and saw it focused towards the endpoint. The same thing exactly, but a different focus. One, a focus on the final perfection, and then we'll talk about how we get there. The other one, let's focus on what we have to do now, and then we'll talk about where we're going. The same reality, but perceived through two different lenses. How did this appear? Understand. How did it appear in the world? It says that Shammai, first of all, I must put in, I don't know how new people are, we must put in, we're talking about people of a level of such spiritual greatness that if they were to appear here tonight, we wouldn't be able to stand it. We wouldn't be able to look at people of this kind of electricity. Many generations later, the Meiri says, at a much, much lower level, in the time of the Amoraim, a whole epoch later, people were at the level that any of them mentioned in the Talmud could revive the dead. There are plenty of examples in the Gemara. So we're talking about people here who at will could revive the dead. We're talking about people of such spiritual power that we to judge them on our terms, in terms of personality. That was given to anger. He was a demanding sort of personality. Or he was a forgiving sort of, you know, like he had problems when he was young, probably his mother shouted at him. The kind of, well, the way we think about, now that obviously is irrelevant. I mean, if you're thinking on that level, it's not worth continuing. We're talking about people so close to human perfection. I mean, we know, I heard from Rav Moshe Feinstein's son, and what can I tell you? I heard from, just to give you some vague suggestion, I heard from the son of Rav Moshe Feinstein that when he was very sick once, and he needed a certain heart procedure, cardiac pacemaker had to be put in, and it failed, and in the second time, I heard from his son and daughter-in-law, that night Rav Moshe lay on his bed, and his wife was there, and Rav Moshe was wondering what it could be that he'd done in his life that could make it necessary that he had to go through this unusual thing twice. And he had it down to four or five things that he'd done in his life. Rav Moshe Feinstein died a few years ago. We're talking about somebody on a generation that isn't the bottom of the instep of a human being compared to Hillel and Shammai. He was able to go through his life and tie down four or five things that he'd ever done that might be responsible. And he wasn't happy which one it was. He couldn't find. And finally, his wife actually pointed out to him, what are you worrying about? So Rav Moshe said, I'm very upset. I can't work out which of the four or five things that I've done in my life is it that generates me to have to go through this unpleasant experience because none of them fit. And his wife said, it's none of them. This is his wife, Rav Moshe's wife. She said, it's none of them. It's because you said in the Goyish Ahant, Likta Hatzola. The problem is that you thought that this doctor is going to put in the pacemaker. You thought that he's got some sort of power to help you. Rav Moshe said, that's it exactly. Anyway, to sleep. We're talking about a man of this generation so clear about his life that he could tie down possibly four, maybe five things that are possibly that he'd done wrong. I mean, so we're talking about Hillel and Shammai, we're talking about people of a voltage that we can't begin to understand. That has to be made clear in more detail, but that's at least, I take a lot of things for granted in each discussion. There are other occasions to build up all the things that you take for granted. We're talking about a human level that's inconceivable for us. How did they function? Shammai, who was the one who always looked at the end point, where we're going, and that was his reality. So the Gemara says, how did he live through the week? The Gemara says he used to get everything that he had in the week and he used to say, do the Shabbos. This is for Shabbos. And he wouldn't eat. And then if he found something that was better, he used to eat the one that he had before and keep the better one for Shabbos. And that's what he'd do, and he'd keep the better one. And the next day, if he could find something better for Shabbos, he put that aside for Shabbos and he ate the other one. And if not, he didn't eat. In other words, you follow what's happening. He didn't sustain himself unless it was for Shabbos. And it says, Aval Hillel, Mida Acheres Haisaboy, it says, that Hillel had a totally different measure. Shekol Maisav L'Shem Shemaim. That everything he did was L'Shem Shemaim. L'Shem Shemaim, you hear that? L'Shem, for the name of Shemaim, Shamim, all the endpoints. Everything he did was there. In other words, Hillel was living at a level where he really was on that level now. That means the daily activity of moving towards Shabbos was Shabbos. You hear that? Hillel never did that. If he got something good today, yes, it's today. Why? They wanted that another one arrived for Shabbos. And the next day, and until he got to Shabbos, he had. But Shammai didn't do that. Everything that he did, he couldn't live through the week. Are you with me? He couldn't live through the week unless everything that he had was geared to Shabbos. And if it was a reality of Shabbos, then, and only then did it leave over a little ma'aser, a little, what's left over for him to eat, for him to live on now. But he couldn't generate any energy. He wouldn't generate any energy for now unless it devolved from the energy of Shabbos. Hillel didn't do that. What's the deep understanding of this? The deep understanding of it is that Hillel Shammai always focused on Shabbos, which is the end point. His whole week was geared to, he lived in Shabbos. The rest of the week lived by a handout from Shabbos, that's all. But Hillel wasn't like that. Hillel was on a level where the week was his definition of reality. And Shabbos was Shabbos, but that means he lived. You know, a fascinating way to see this. Let's try and understand more deeply. Where do you see it? The Gemara illustrated it. The Gemara illustrated it as follows. The Gemara says that a man came, a childhood story, every child in Cheder learns the story. So understand it on a deeper level now. It says that a man came to try and try the patience of Shammai and Hillel. I'm sure everyone's familiar with the story. The Gemara says openly, the whole Amud Gemara. A man came to try their patience. Classic story that's brought down everywhere. He came to try and sort of mock them and tease them and belittle them in order to see if he could try their patience. Why? Because he had a bet with his friends, the Gemara said, 400 zuz. 400 zuz is a fortune. It's enough to live on for a year or more. A great fortune in those days. He had a bet with his friend that he could make them angry. So he went to Shammai and he asked him a question, a nonsensical question, impossible question. And Shammai chased him away with this. It says that Shammai used to walk around with Amas HaBinyan Bayadoi. He used to walk around with a stick in his hand. Amas HaBinyan means a builder's rule, a builder's yard. You know, a yardstick by which you. He chased him away as if in anger. And then he went to Hillel and he started the same nonsense with Hillel. Before we go any further, you have to understand, it doesn't mean Shammai walked around with, he wasn't a builder. Shammai sat in Beis Medrash all day, he walked around with a Gemara in his hand. That's what he walked around with. He didn't walk around, he probably didn't have that either, he knew it by heart. But he walked around, when the Gemara says he walked around with a builder's yard, it means he did everything by measure, that's what it means. It means everything by him was applied to the measure of perfection, and if it measured up, yes, and if it didn't, it, because he measured everything according to the standard of perfection. So this man came to Hillel, classic Gemara, and he arrives outside Hillel's house. Hillel, the Nasi of Israel, the prince of the Jewish people, the leader of the Jewish people in that generation, he was the Nasi, and Shammai was the Av Beis Din, the head of the Beis Din, the Sanhedrin. And Hillel was the head of the entire Jewish nation, what's called the Nasi, the princely leader of the Jewish people, descended from the house of David. Hillel was in the bath on Friday afternoon. So this man arrives outside Hillel's house, and he starts shouting, out loud in the street for everyone to hear, Mi Kan Hillel. That means, who's here called Hillel? By his first name. By his first name he refers to him. And Mikan Hillel, as if to say, who's here called Hillel? Like, I never heard of this man. But they talk about somebody called Hillel. You hear the insult. First of all, shouting him out in the street. Secondly, Erev Shabbos, when Hillel's getting ready for Shabbos. Thirdly, he calls him by his first name. And fourthly, he asks the question, who's called Hillel over here? Anybody here called Hillel? Imagine the degradation of it. Why did he do this? The Rambam explains, others explain. Because he was trying to insult Hillel to win his bet. He was trying to insult him in the covet of Torah. He knew that if he insulted Hillel as a human being, Hillel would let it wash off his back. Hillel was the epitome of being a nobody. Once when they asked Hillel where he was going, he said he's going to take care of the poor hotel where he stays. He's going to take care, he stays in lodgings, and he has to devote some time to taking care of the lodgings where he stays. Where was he going? To the shower, to the mikveh, to have a shower. He meant that he lives in a humble hotel, humble abode, and he has to take care of it. That's what he meant. And he didn't even use me, he said Hillel. That was it. Hillel was a man, he was a wood chopper, he used to chop wood. And once he didn't have the 2 kopecks or whatever the money was that you needed to go to the Beis Medrash, he lay on the snow in the roof. It says that the teachers of that generation, I think it was a Rishon, no, it was Shmaya Naphtali, the great teachers of that generation, they were learning Torah in the Beis Medrash, and it was dark that day. So what happened to the sun? So they looked up and they saw the shape of a frozen man on the skylight. The snow had piled up on him and he was frozen solid. And they brought him in, they said, this man's destined for greatness. He couldn't afford to get in. He didn't use that as an excuse. He lay on the skylight, putting his ear to the glass, trying to hear a few words of Torah. Until he froze solid, and they had to bring him in and warming up. And they said, that's it. He was a nobody, complete. That's it. So this man knew that Hillel behaved like a nobody. And he knew that he wouldn't stand on his covet, on his honor. But he knew that Hillel, as a Nasi, had to stand up for the honor of the Jewish people. And that's why he thought he'd be able to rattle him. And what Hillel, and there is a din like that. Shammai was acting exactly according to Halacha. Shammai, as the Av Beis Din of Jewish people, couldn't tolerate such a fool. Not because he was impatient, he was in perfect control of his personality. Perfect. Every flicker of an eyelid was perfectly controlled. But as leader of the Beis Din, he had to represent that power of being demanding, because that's the honor of the Jewish people in Torah. He had to do that. That was his role. We'll try and explain later why. But Hillel was teaching that despite being in that position, he could afford not to be rattled by this individual, as you'll see in the story. Why? Because at the end of the day, it's still a personal insult. That means
that what he was teaching here was that it was questionable whether you should look at such a personal insult as being vested in the personality of the leader of the Jewish people, or whether, since it's nonsense, one can see it as personal. That's a very, very deep question. Hillel taught that despite the threat to the honor of the leader of the Jewish people that he represented, he could still afford to be. So he came out in his bathrobe and he said, "Yes, my son." So the man asked him a string of the most inane questions. "Why do the Patagonians have wide feet?" he asked Hillel. So Hillel said, "I'll tell you why, my son. They live where the sands are soft, and they've got wide feet so they don't sink into the sand." What do you say to an answer like that? So he went away. Hillel went back to his bath. Erev Shabbos, by the way. Erev Shabbos is a time of the greatest tension. Erev Shabbos is when women, husbands and wives who don't fight, that's when they fight on Erev Shabbos. In families where things are fine, Erev Shabbos is when they fight. Because that's the tension, you've got to get ready by Shabbos. And that's when the thing, one Hasidic Rebbe, who's a Rosh Hashiva in Yerushalayim, he told me Erev Shabbos he goes to sleep. The tension is too dangerous. He sleeps Erev Shabbos. So he said, the Hasidic custom. Hasidic custom. I said, "What about helping your wife?" He just smiled, gave a broad smile. I said, "Helping your wife, Erev Shabbos," gave a broad smile. "I got to sleep." So he does. I'm not recommending it, I'm just telling you. Erev Shabbos is a time of tension. So Hillel's getting ready at the last minute, the responsibility of the whole Jewish nation on his shoulders. He's getting ready at the last minute, and he chooses that time. You understand what's going on here? He chooses that time when it's the most fragile time in a person. But there's a much deeper message. You remember what we said? That Shammai worked towards Shabbos? That's exactly the time to catch it. He went to bother these men when the week reaches its perfection, at the moment of transition into perfection, which is what they both were holding by at that point. And of course, that's exactly why he couldn't rattle Hillel. He couldn't. What he was doing by Shammai was he's breaking that transition into perfection. But by Hillel, he lived that way all the time. So Hillel went back to his bath. Story continues. He came back again and he shouted out in the street, "Mikan Hillel, Mikan Hillel." Hillel came out in his bathrobe patiently and said, "Yes, my son." And the man said to him, "Why do the Chinese have slit eyes?" So I said, "I'll tell you, my son. They live where there are a lot of sandy winds. And they've got thin slit eyes. The sand doesn't get in their eyes." Back to his bath. Another inane question. After a list of inane questions, and Hillel answered each one, but what the questions mean mystically is another story. But anyway. After a list of inane questions, the man said to Hillel the following words, "Because of you, I've lost 400 zus. I've lost a lot of money because of you." And Hillel said, "My son, it is better that you lost that amount of money than Hillel should get angry." Didn't even refer to himself by the word I or me. Often you can judge a person's personality by how often in his conversation the word I or me appears. He said, "Better that you should lose that money than Hillel should get angry." So the man said, "May there not be many like you in Israel." That was his blessing that he gave the Nasi. Hillel went back to his bath and the man lost his money. What do you see? Hillel taught that even when that's at stake, at that tense time, with all that has to be gone down in history as Torah, we learn Torah from that he was able to be. You see this, for those who've got a little halachic background, you see a fascinating, fantastic, literally fantastic issue, which is that halachically, Hillel and Shammai always argue. Actually, Hillel and Shammai themselves didn't argue. They only argued about three things, the Gemara says. There are only three times in the Gemara where Hillel and Shammai personally argue. But their students, who followed schools of thought, that followed their line of thinking, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, those two large schools of thought argued about many, many, possibly thousands of things. It says, "Sherabu hamachlekes b'Yisrael," until the Torah was like two Torahs, almost, that's for sure. They argued about everything. If you look at the argument between the line of Hillel and the line of Shammai, you'll see a fascinating thing. A person who doesn't understand any of this, who learns Talmud or learns Halacha, you'll see that there are arguments about many things that you wouldn't understand why they bothered to argue. For example, there's a fascinating argument between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai whether the heavens were created first or the earth was created first. Ma nivra tchila? Shamayim nivru tchila or aretz nivra tchila? What was created first? First the heavens? We don't mean the sky. We mean the transcendent dimension of spirituality. Was that first created or was the earth first created? Everybody knows, of course, that the pathway is from earth to heaven. The word aretz, I'm not going to go into this in detail, but the word aretz in Hebrew means running. Hashem haritza, it means it moves, it runs. So the world is running towards Shamim, all the theirs where there's no more movement. That's what it means. So what was created first? The pathway that runs towards the spiritual reality, or the end point of spiritual perfection created first, and then the world that draws towards it was created? A big argument here, Hillel and Shammai. And there's a third opinion of Shimon bar Yochai. He says, "Tamua ani al avos ha'olam." I'm surprised at these fathers of the world, that they argue about such a thing. Everybody knows that it was Kedera b'Ilfas Kedarab Ilfas, I think it says, that the world was created like a pot and a lid. That means both exactly at the same time. Always, as you know, in Kabbalistic thinking, there's one pole, another pole, and then the third that ties them together. That's another story for another time. But that's the argument. There's many, many arguments. There's a place where Hillel and Shammai are arguing straightforward halach about how you light Hanukkah candles. A few months' time, Mr. Shem, we'll come to Hanukkah. There's a big argument. Hillel says, you light the candles 1 the first night, 2 the second night, 3 the third night, and so on till 8. Shammai says you light 8 the first night, 7 the next, and so forth down to 1. Now what exactly is going on? And if you follow this argument throughout halacha, you'll find all over, you'll find these arguments. Of course, everybody knows that the line of Shammai is always the strict line. It's always the strict line of reasoning in halacha, the more demanding line. You have to live on a stricter level. Hillel is always the lenient line. If there are two options and we can take the lenient, Hillel takes the lenient. Almost always, there are exceptions, but almost always, Beis Hillel takes the line of leniency. Beis Shammai takes the line of strength, obviously. But if you follow it in detail through the arguments in Gemara, you'll see it's fascinating. Let's take the two examples we mentioned. Whether the heavens were created first. Obviously, Shammai holds that the heavens were created first because that's the dimension of perfection. Obviously, that's what's created first. That's the essence. And then we create the world, which is a building up towards that perfection. But Hillel, obviously, Hillel holds the world is created. I hope you're with me that in mystical thinking, there's no first. Now, the heavens weren't created first and then the world after that. Obviously, you know that we have a principle in Kabbalistic argument that both sides are true. You know that when there's an argument in the Kabbalistic, in what's called Agadita, in the metaphysical dimension, then there's a principle that both sides are true. Only they are bringing out a different facet of reality. That means there's nothing created first. Of course the third opinion's right, that we're created together. Are you with me? But it means that which side do we focus on in our human consciousness? So the one opinion is that the heaven, of course we look at perfection first, and then we look at the finite reality that builds. Hillel says, no, of course not. The world's created first, and it builds up to where it's going. And of course you can see it everywhere, candles. Hillel says, of course you light one candle first. Because we start with them, with the finite and the minute. We start with imperfection. And the next night too, and we end up at perfection. And Shammai, of course not. We start with a full glow of 8 lights. And then we work down to the experienced reality. And you see it in all the arguments. In case you think that these are arbitrary arguments, that they just, you know, happen to hold a different position, they're both bringing out different facets and aspects of reality, each according to the line that they're represented in the world. Now, that is the idea, very, very briefly, of who was Hillel and who was Shammai. Now let's try and see, in very, very, very brief overview. Person who wants to get more insight must read Pirkei Avos and see the pathway of transmission and what the Maharal says over there. You have to do a lot of research to get just any clarity about this idea, but that is the most bare bones of the idea. Now, let's try and trace where did these two lines come from in the mystical world and where did they go to in Jewish history. Now, the idea is like this. I'm not going to go into detail, but the general idea is as follows. We have a tradition that we follow Hillel, we don't follow Shammai. We follow the line, what the Maharal calls the right-hand side, the sign of gentleness and kindness and giving, and not the line of strict and absolute discipline. We follow the line of Hillel. If today we have to make a decision in halachic matters between an opinion of Hillel or Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, we follow the line of Beis Hillel, the lenient side. Right? Not because he's right. If anything, as I'm sure you can begin to feel, if you could use the word right, it's Beis Shammai. Because in Hashem's world, where things are as they are, on the level of perfection, so obviously that's the higher level. But we follow the lenient side because we can't hold by the level of perfection. It doesn't mean that he's any more right than Beis Shammai. First of all, nobody's right. They're both right. But if you want to say on a higher level spiritually, if you would like to speak that way, if anything, Shammai, Beis Shammai is the higher level. Just that the judgment of the Chazal, Chachamim, the sages, is that we can't hold by that level and get it right. So we need to be treated with, unfortunately, we need excuses to be made for us. We need to be put on the level of leniency, as it were. And we follow Hashem. There are many opinions in the Kabbalistic thinkers and elsewhere that when the Mashiach comes, we'll live like Beis Shammai. That the halachic application, today we live like Beis Hillel. If you want to know whether to be strict or lenient in certain matters that are argument, we live like Beis Hillel. But after the Messianic revelation, where we're all holding in a level much closer to perfection, so then we'll be able to hold by the level of what's called din. Din means absolute strict justice, the way things exactly should be. You get what you deserve and you have to earn what you get. But today we live on a level where we don't have to earn what we get. Baruch Hashem, thank God for that, because we're struggling to cope even with all the handouts that we're given spiritually. But we have to have that. And when the Jewish generations got to a level where they couldn't hold anymore by the perfection of Beis Shammai, so there was a massive decision made that from now on in, Beis Shammai b'makom Hillel eino Mishnah. that the opinion of Beis Shammai in the face of the opinion of Beis Hillel is no longer Mishnah. In other words, it holds no halachic validity. Not it's wrong, Chas v'Shalom. If anything, it's higher. But we no longer can hold by that. We close it out. And from now on in, we go like the pathway of Beis Hillel. The Gemara says, why? Because they were self-effacing, they were humble. The Gemara says, because they quoted the words of Beis Shammai before their own. But Beis Hillel used to quote a halachic argument. You have to understand what it means to argue in Torah. Not like we think arguments are vicious personal attacks. They used to quote an argument. They used to quote first the opposition and then themselves. They used to say, Beis Shammai hold the following, and then they used to say what they held. They first put the opposition first. You have to understand what Torah argumentation is. I'll give you an example. The Gemara says that they had violent arguments, enormous arguments about who's Jewish and who's not, who's of kosher Jewish stock and who isn't, according to certain marriages between certain people who may or may not be related to each other, whether the child is formed as a mamzer or not. You're with me. And the child has certain spiritual negativity attached to that child, which means that that child can never marry a Jew. They had a difference of opinion about what unions, what marriages constitute such and which don't. And they held so strongly, that means that when Beis Shammai held that this and this is okay and that isn't, and Beis Hillel held the opposite, so you know what it means. It means that, you hear what's happening, it means according to Beis Shammai, their community that did the way they held, so the children were all fine. But knowing that Beis Hillel held the other way, they knew that there were children born to families following the pathway of Beis Hillel who were not fine at all, with whom it was forbidden to marry. And Beis Hillel held that their children were fine because they held that the way they held was correct, obviously, but they knew that in the camp of Beis Shammai, there were children being born who were forbidden to marry. And what happened? They let their children marry each other. You hear that? That's the way Jews argue. That's the way Jews argue. That means the arguments couldn't have been more violent. Not just opinions. They knew they were right. And they knew they were right. And they knew their child was a mamzer. And when two children wanted to marry each other, they gave their blessing and they went to the chasana. But understand this. That's the way Jews argue. Anybody's familiar a little bit with Yiddish or that you hear the curses? The way other nations curse. If you permit it, I'd give you some examples. I traveled through Europe once. Understood enough to understand what they were saying. Can't bring myself to repeat it. Not unclean, just blasphemous. The way Jews curse each other. The worst I've ever heard my Rebbe say. The worst I've ever heard him say. I've heard him say things that would have fried me had he said them to me. But the worst is when he says, Tia Bari. May you be healthy. Person asked the question, that's the worst of the worst. Just in Tia Bari. May you be healthy. No, you understand that? When you get that bracha, you know you're really in trouble. That's how they argued, and that's what happened. So let's understand again. You had Hillel and Shammai. They argued about three things. Their descendants, their schools of thought, argued about many, many more things. Because they didn't serve their teachers as well as they could have in previous generations, it says. So they fell to a point where much less clarity existed. A lot of argumentation arose in these two schools. And finally, there was a generation of Tanoim, a couple of centuries later than Hillel himself and Shammai himself, where towards the end of the generations of the Tanoim in the days of Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, which was the generation just before Rabbi Akiva, which, if you're familiar a little with Jewish history, was around the destruction of the Second Temple just after. One or two generations after the destruction of the Second Temple, which took place in 70 of the Common Era, about 1900 years ago, 1920 years ago, around then was when these great men lived. At that time, there was a decision made in Jewish history, an amazing, amazing watershed decision, that from now on in, Beis Shammai has no opinion. Although it's higher, I hope that's clear, although it's higher, but we can't live there. We've fallen to a point now where it's not relevant anymore, and they closed it out. And let's understand how this happened, and what happened. And from then on, Beis Hillel holds sway. And whenever the Gemara brings both opinions, always we know that the halachic weight is on the side of Beis Hillel. Us, at our level. Now, the Gemara says the following. You have to understand this. A very, very incredible thing. How did it happen? First of all, briefly, Jewish history. This is what happened. Anybody who wants to know more about this, we just can't go into detail. There are two wonderful books written which give you in point form Jewish history from a Jewish perspective, not the anti-Semitic Jewish writers who present a Jewish history through non-Jewish apologetic eyes. And the two that I can recommend, there are many, but the two that I can recommend are Behold the People and Torah Nation by Miller, Rabbi Victor Miller. Those two books put in point form from Josephus and from the Gemara's Jewish history. They're essential reading, you just can't do without them. Or some equivalent. Rather than being poisoned by the... And they give the political reality at the time and what was happening in the political, socio-political sphere, not only Torah sphere, and how they enmesh with each other. Now, What happened historically, very, very briefly, was this. After Hillel and Shammai, their students formed two schools. The schools formed the school of Beis Hillel, the school of Beis Shammai, and everybody who lived in subsequent generations fitted into one of those two schools of thought halachically. When it got down to the level of Rabbi Akiva, and we have a tradition that Rabbi Akiva was the total mouthpiece of the whole Torah Shabbat, of the whole oral law. Kulam alibad Rabbi Akiva, says. Everything was according to Rabbi Akiva's opinion. He was the one who summarized, according to the Arizal, he was a reincarnation of something very, very high from a much, much earlier generation. He was the one who was the trumpet, the mouthpiece of the whole oral law. Rabbi Akiva lived in an amazing, amazing crisis of Jewish history. What happened was this. He had the amazing position in history that he studied under two men. He learned Torah by two teachers who represented both schools. He learned by a great Tanna called Rabbi Yeshua, and he learned by a great Tanna called Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer ben. Rabbi Eliezer, Godel, Rabbi Eliezer, the great, he's called, of course he's called the great. He, Rabbi Eliezer, was the one who represented the side of Beis Shammai, and he held that it was correct. In that generation of Rabbi Akiva, a decision had to be made how the Jewish people were now going to conduct themselves. Would we perpetuate the argument and decide each thing on its merits as time went by, or would we now decide according that Beis Hillel would be the mainstream and Beis Shammai or vice versa? Rabbi Akiva learned from both, and he was one of those few, he and his chaverim, responsible for making the decision that Rabbi Eliezer would be closed out and no longer would we continue in that way, even though he was his Rebbe, and we would go like his other Rebbe, Rebbe Yeshua, and continue and propagate the line of Beis Hillel. Can you imagine the emotions? Can you imagine the generation when he had to decide against one of his Rebbeim? Can you imagine? And that the vote would go like Rebbe Yeshua, like the line of Beis Hillel. So I'll tell you what happened. Listen to what happened. Unbelievable. We've discussed one or two of these details in other contexts. This is what happened. One day in the Sanhedrin, in the Beis Medrash, in that body of almost prophetic men, a decision had to be made about a certain oven. The halachic shaila, the halachic question came up about whether a certain oven was tamei or tahor, pure or impure. Ritually, let's say, mystically, kabbalistically, pure or impure. So what happened was Rabbi Yeshua got up. He was the, again, a Nazi and Abbasid, and at least they were the heads of the Jewish people. Rabbi Yeshua got up and he said a certain decision, and they took a vote, and the vote was like him. The vote was like him. Now, there's a Torah principle that you go with a vote. Acharei rabim lahatos. If there's a vote, everybody must agree with the majority, and you must go with the vote. So they voted that it was one way. Got onto his feet, Rabbi Eliezer, and he said, "You're all wrong. I'm the minority. I'm a sole lone opinion, but you're all wrong. And I don't care about votes. We go with what's right. What do you mean you're voting? So you all voted wrong. But I'm right." Now you have to understand what's going on. The point at issue here, you have to have a little bit of halachic sensitivity over here. The point at issue was whether a vote is what carries sway, or whether what's right holds sway. What's right in Hashem's eyes? What's right? Or what we vote is right? Listen carefully. What does Hashem regard as right? He himself personally in Shemayim, Hashem, God, what does he regard as right? What is right, in fact? Or since he put in his Torah that I want you human beings to vote, and I will then ratify that as correct, so which holds, and that was the argument. Rabbi Eliezer couldn't accept the vote, because he held that a vote's not valid. You follow? The others held that even if Rabbi Eliezer's right, it makes no difference, because once we vote, and we establish the law this way, that's what the Torah wants, and that's what Hashem agrees with. And Rabbi Eliezer held that we don't vote. We do what Hashem thinks, if we know. And everybody agreed that Beis Shammai was sharper than Beis Hillel. Everybody agreed that Beis Shammai was sharper and higher than Beis Hillel, and they could see more accurately what Hashem wanted. But Beis Hillel felt that despite that knowledge, we vote. Can you hear what's going on? It's an insoluble problem. Because you can't solve the problem by voting, because he holds the votes no good. And you can't vote on that. You follow? You hear what's going on? If there ever was a stalemate in Jewish history, in the history of the world, that was it. What were they to do? So Rabbi Shua got on his feet and he said, halacha is like this, decision final, everybody voted. Rabbi Leah got up and he said like this, "You're all wrong, and the vote's invalid, and I'm right, and I'm going to prove it to you." How would he prove it? What's he going to say? He said, "I want that carob tree outside." There was a carob tree outside the basement. "I want that carob tree to get up and walk." The carob tree uprooted itself and it walked. So the whole Olam turned around, they looked at the two great Rebbeim. Rabbi Yeshua got up on his feet and he said, Lo b'shamayim hi, the Torah is not in Shamayim, you can't prove anything from carob trees, got no validity in halacha, we go with the boat. Rabbi Eliezer got up and he said, you see that river outside? There was a stream running past the base. I wanted to turn around and run backwards. The water turned around and flowed uphill. Rabbi Yeshua got on his feet and he said, Lo b'shamayim. This was Rabbi Eliezer of God. Do you know who he was? Rabbi Eliezer was a man, he was a young man and knew nothing. He was singled out for greatness by one of the greats, by I think Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Eliezer Godel. And he left his home and he went to learn Torah from the greats in Yerushalayim. His father disowned him. Completely. Swore an oath that he would never give him anything. And when he became the greatest man of his generation, his father came one day to Jerusalem to hear him darshaning, to hear him saying a shir. And his father sat in the audience and he saw it was his son. And he was saying words that the angels were singing. Fire was surrounding. He saw things like that. He got up. He had to get them to undo his vow. And he got them to undo his, and he gave everything to his son. When he saw what he'd achieved. His son used to eat sand. He was so lowly, he had nothing when he came there. They had once complained about his breath because he had to eat earth. That was really as a god what he gave up to learn Torah. And he became the greatest man of his generation. So he said to them, if I'm right, I want the walls of the Beis Medrash to cave in. Again, the significance of these things I'm not going to go into now. The water, the tree, the walls. But anyway, I want the, and the walls started to cave in. And the Gemara says that out of respect to Rabbi Yeshua, they stayed where they were. And out of respect to Rabbi Yeshua, they caved. And they stayed at a position hung in the air. Rabbi Yeshua got up on his feet under the hanging walls of the Beis Medrash. And he saw Lo b'shamayim hi. It's got nothing to do with these mystical things. The vote is like we said. So Rabbi Yeshua said one last thing. Rabbi Eliezer, he said like this. I want a voice to come out of heaven. I want you to hear a voice from heaven, what's called a bas kol. I want you to hear a voice saying that I'm right. And they heard a voice. And the voice said, Halacha k'Rabbi Eliezer b'kol mokim. That the law is like Rabbi Eliezer everywhere, not just here. Rabbi Yeshua got up on his feet and he said, Lo b'shamayim, it's not in heaven. The Torah is here with us and we vote. And they put Rabbi Eliezer into shamta, they put him into excommunication. He wouldn't accept the vote of the majority. He wouldn't accept the vote because he held the vote was invalid. What was he supposed to do? So Rabbi Akiva and his friends, who were students of this incredible great man, had to put him into what's called shamta. The Gemara calls him Shamuti. Shamuti means, there are two opinions of the Gemara. One means it's from the name Shammai, because he followed the pathway by Shammai. And another means the word Shamta. Shamta means excommunication, total halachic exile. You're not allowed to speak to him. You're not allowed to go within Dalit Amas of him. And Amma is a cubit. You may not enter his four cubits. You may not go near the man. You may have nothing to do with him. He's in total halachic excommunication. Rabbi Eliezer, the greatest man of his generation, what's going on here? You must not understand this as like a personal, you know, whose opinion would hold sway. It had nothing to do with that. There was nothing personal about it at all. There are many examples of people of that generation when they were proved wrong, the B'nai B'Seira. When Hillel himself came from Eretz Yisrael, from Babel to Eretz Yisrael, he said a certain halacha that they didn't, and they stepped down immediately, and he took over. They stepped down. They didn't want the position. They weren't interested in leadership. Not like today's politicians. The only thing they want is leadership. They don't care about you. The leadership of the Jewish people, they only cared about the Torah and what was right. When Hillel said something they didn't, and they stepped down immediately, and they forced him to take over. There was nothing personal about this argument, nothing at all personal. But what could they do to this man who wouldn't accept the vote? They couldn't function. So they had to put him into Shamta, they put him into Chayrim. What happened? And from that time on, the opinion of Beis Hillel was the one that held sway in the world. That had been the decision. But Beis Shammai, B'makom Beis Hillel, and a Mishnah. And Beis Shammai in the world got closed out until the Mashiach comes, when we'll again activate their opinion. And that's why we study it in the Gemara. We'll again live on that level where we can justify our actions, where we can live more strictly because we can hold by that intense level of judgment. Now we need excuses to be made for us. We need to live at our level. That's what happened. What was the end of the story? What was the end of the story? Let's understand. The way this developed, let's try and interweave here a little of the background. The Maharal explains like this. When Torah was given to Moses, to Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai, it was given intact to one man. Moshe gave it to Joshua, intact to one man. Yeshua gave it to the Zakanim, the elders, intact to one man. Each of them received the whole Torah. Zakanim to the Nevi'im, to the prophets, each prophet received the whole Torah. Absolutely the totality of Torah. The prophets gave it to Anshei Knesset HaGdolah through the generations, the men of the great assembly. Each of them received the whole Torah, although they were a body of individuals, but each one received it perfect. The Anshei Knesset HaGdolah gave the Torah to a man called Shimon HaTzadik, who was in the generation after the men of the great assembly. We're talking a few centuries here before the beginning of the common era, approximately. He received the Torah intact. He gave it over to a man called Antignos Ish Soichoi, who was the first Jew who lived in a generation where no one saw prophets. Now already the world was darkening. Prophecy, that level of incredible spiritual light, had left the world. Antignos Ish Soichoi was the first man who had in his base medrash, he had two students who went off the rails. For the first time in Jewish history, they started a reform movement. They went off the rails and they began a movement which caused terrible suffering to the Jewish people for centuries. The Sadducees that stuck him. After him, but he had the Torah intact, just they misunderstood something that he said. The next generation were two people called Yossi ben Yochanan and Yossi ben Yoezer. And here says the Maral, for the first time in the history of the world, the Torah could no longer be contained by one man. And it was given over to two men, both with the same name. Incredible. Yossi ben Yoezer, Yossi ben Yochanan. One was given the Jerusalem side, one was given the other side. Be that as it may, they both received the Torah, but they received it as a partnership. They had the totality, but they could only hold it as two. There was nothing lost. The Torah was perfectly maintained, but only by two. One represented the right-hand side of Torah, one represented the left-hand side. One represented what generations later would be Hillel, and one represented what generations later would be Shammai. They had it intact. At the end of their days, it says, how you made in Torah commotion, can be Moshe Rabbeinu. They learned in their generation until then, they learned Torah as it was from Moses. Because Moshe Rabbeinu gave the Torah intact, and it never broke down until then. Asayf Yemehen. Shall Yossi ben Yochanan and Yossi ben Yoezer. Until the end of the days of these two great men, when they began to argue about one thing. There's a certain argument about sacrifices, whether you lay hands on a korban and yom tov. They had an argument. And for five generations that argument raged between, and of course, each of them occupied the two positions. Yossi ben Yochanan and Yossi ben Yoezer. One of them was the Nasi, the prince at the head of the Jewish people, and one was the Av Beis Din. The word Din, Beis Din, is the left-hand side, the side of judgment and justice. And the Nasi is the one who's elevated, yes, and heads the whole system. These two men began the right and the left-hand sides in Torah for the first time. Prophecy was no longer around to be that unifying voice. They now handed it over. The end of their days began a machlekes. In the generation after that, Yeshua ben Prachya and Nitai Harabeli, two great, great, incredible men, one continued the tradition of being the head of the Beis Din, at the left-hand side of Din, and one continued the tradition of being the right-hand side, and they received Torah between them, and they still argued about the same thing. There was still that argument raging, and they both held the same positions as their predecessors because of what they represented in the Jewish people, and the breakdown continued further. Rabbi Shua ben Prachya had a student who became the founder of Christianity, went off the rails completely, became the founder of that religion that has been the source of so much torture to the Jewish people. Certain reasons, he made a mistake in learning, and his Rebbe couldn't correct him, and he thought he was rejected. The whole story, the Gemara says, and he went, another discussion. The next generation, they argued about the same thing. And the next generation again, and the next generation, the fifth one, there were five from Moshe until Shimon Tzaddik, and five from them until Hillel and Shammai. By the time Hillel and Shammai came, the fifth, the last of that series of 12, I'm going to go into the details now. The last, always the world's created in fives. You have to discuss 10 things which form five energies. We'll have to discuss that another time. But Hillel and Shammai then argued about three things. Only three things in the whole of the infinite multiplicity of Torah, of Halacha, they only disagreed about three things. And after them, their students, it says, were not able to serve their teachers with the intensity that the previous generations had been able to. Rabba Machlekes for Yisrael, many arguments arose in the Jewish people, and the schools of Hillel and Shammai appeared in the world. That's the history of how it happened. That's the history of how it happened. What was the end? The end was like this. In the generation that closed this discussion, when Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, the great Rabbi Eliezer, was around, and Rabbi Yeshua, his great Chavrusa, was around. I understand you. What do these people look like? Do you know what they looked like? What did they look like? The Gemara says that they were a Chavrusa, by the way. In the Gemara you find them together. Chavrusa, intense relationship between the two of them. Rabbi Yeshua, the one who closed out Rabbi Eliezer, who voted him out and ended his line, his own friend, his own Chavrusa, right? He had to end his line. And Rabbi Eliezer held he was wrong to do so. He had to close it off by the vote. And his friend Rabbi Eliezer, how did they look like? The Gemara says that Rabbi Yeshua was so ugly, he was so screamingly ugly that it was unbelievable. The Gemara says that the daughter of the Caesar, this was under Roman rule, once asked him how it was possible that such wisdom could be in such an ugly vessel. And the Gemara records the whole conversation. It was hideously ugly. Rabbi Eliezer was so beautiful. He was so beautiful. Unbelievably beautiful. He represents perfection, where the inner beauty and the outer beauty are in harmony, and Rabbi Yeshua represented the opposite. Remarkable thing. Anyway, what happened? Reb Eliezer died. One day, he was dying. After a long time that his own students hadn't been speaking to him. Not out of anything personal, they couldn't speak to him because he was in Chairin. He was excommunicated. They couldn't learn Torah from him. So Reb Eliezer was exiled into a situation where his Torah never came out into the world, because that was the generation of the Jewish people couldn't hear that Torah. They couldn't act on that Torah. You follow? So he was in the outside. He was outside in what's called Chairin. On the day that he died, they came to visit him. As he lay on his deathbed, Rabbi Akiva and the other Tanoim of his generation, the ones who had all banded together, again, we're not talking personally. I hope nobody's understanding this wrongly. I'll say it again and again. They had all grouped into the following the pathway of Beis Hillel, which was correct for that generation. Reb Eliezer had not been able to give out his Torah from that time on because it wasn't held by the generation. As he died, they came to the Mavaka Chole, they came to visit him. They walked into his house to visit him, to speak to him, as he lay on his deathbed. And it says, I mean, can you imagine the pain? It says, Yashvu Berichuk Dalet Amos. They had to sit 4 amos away from him. He was in Chairin. They couldn't approach him. They had to sit 4 amos away to observe the halacha. Rabbi Akiva's own Rebbe had to come face to face with his own Rebbe. Rabbi Eliezer said to them, what have you come for? Why are you here? So they said, we've come to learn Torah. So he said, now, where have you been? Where have you been till now? And as he died, it says, he folded his arms across his chest, and he said, like a sefer Torah that's rolled cannot be read, so am I rolled, closed, and you'll never know the Torah that could have been there from the sefer Torah. Before he died, as he lay on his deathbed, and they were visiting him, they were sitting there, he said to them, why didn't you come till now? And they said to him the following incredible words. They said to him, Lo hayo lanu pnai. We didn't have time. We didn't have free time. We didn't have any time. Lo hayo lanu pnai. Pnai is the Hebrew word which means, pnai means free time. Panui means emptiness. No free time. We don't have free time. So the Mefoshim explained it doesn't mean that in inane answer like that, you have to understand, it doesn't mean we didn't have free time. Just go and learn Torah from the greatest Rebbe who was alive. It means we didn't have free time. We didn't have free space. We were filled with Beis Hillel. You follow? We were filled with the Torah of what's needed for this generation. We didn't have a place to put Beis Shammai. Not because there's anything wrong with your Torah, Chas v'Shalom, it's on a higher level. But we can only hold Beis Shammai now in this generation. You follow what they meant? We didn't have... When they said that to him, Rabbi Eliezer said the following words. Listen to this. He spoke to himself, and the Gemara records his words. He said the following words. Tamua ani im yamusu misas atzman. He said the following amazed words to himself. I would be very surprised if these people die a natural death. That's what he said. These people who closed out this Torah, he wasn't saying it personally again. So there's no personal emotion here at all. I would be very surprised if they died. You know how those people died? They were torn apart by the Romans. One was burnt to death, burnt alive by the Romans. One was skinned alive, flayed, skinned alive. Right? Skinned him alive, took his skin off while he was alive. They were tortured to death by the Romans. Gruesome and abysmal. You know in Yom Kippur, we read the torture of the 10 martyrs to make us cry in Yom Kippur. We read the torture of these people. These were they. These were the people. These were the people. Before they died, Rabbi Eliezer commented to himself quietly, I would be very surprised if these people die a natural death. Just understand what's going on here. Why did he say that? Why did he say that? What did he mean? How did he know? How did he know? How did he know that? How could a great man like that, was he vindictive? Chas v'shalom. Did he want them, Chas v'shalom, to die like that? Let's understand a little more sensitively here. It means, obviously, the following thing. They had rejected the pathway of justice. They had taken the pathway of softness and forgiving and understanding. They had rejected the pathway where man lives up to his own standards and earns what he gets. The punishment for such people who make such a mistake, who take the Jewish people out of the world, where they earn their own fate, into the world where they cannot anymore earn their own fate, the punishment is that they die the death of a person who gets what he deserves. We die death, yes? The way the world dies in Beis Hillel's mode is not what you deserve. Mefoshim say that if you disobey Hashem at all, Rambam writes clearly, if you disobey, to this effect, if you disobey Hashem at all, doesn't matter how small a disobedience, doesn't matter what avera you do, doesn't matter how small a tiny detail of your Jewish obligation you don't live up to, the punishment is horrendous in reality. Because you're disobeying the king. If the king asks his son to do something for him, it doesn't matter what it is, it could be a token action. But if the son disobeys, he disobeys blatantly and flagrantly, disobeys the king. It's not the action that happens, it's the disobedience. And therefore, when a Jew does something, no matter how infinitesimally wrong, the punishment is torture. most gruesome torture, the most incredible sufferings. That's what a person deserves. Says in Mephoshim that all the suffering of this world doesn't begin to amount to the suffering of the next world. But at least the maximum that can be given in this world is what a person deserves. At least that. But fortunately, Baruch Hashem, we don't have that. Because we don't live at the level where we have to answer for our actions exactly according to the strict middah of what's called din, strict justice. Well, what's the punishment for these people? You hear what was going through his mind, Rabbi Eliezer. These are people who rejected that pathway and shouldn't have. Obviously, middah keneged middah. Obviously, what's going to happen to them must be this kind of... You hear how he's thinking? At that point, Rabbi Akiva leaned forward and he said to Rabbi Eliezer, Mashali. Rabbi Akiva leaned forward and he said to his Rabbi, and what about me? Rabbi Eliezer looked at him and he said, Shalcha kasha mekunam. Yours will be harder than theirs. Rabbi Akiva was raked apart. The Romans tore his flesh off his body and sold the meat for Roman dogs. They sold the flesh. They tore him apart. Rabbi Akiva, remember the story? He was saying Shema while they raked him apart with iron. They sold the flesh. It says in the Gemara, Machru es besare b'makulim. They sold his flesh in the Makulim, the general store. They sold his flesh. Romans walked in and bought pieces of Rabbi Akiva's flesh, which they gave to their dogs. Can you imagine such a thing? It says when that happened in Shamayim, the Medrash says Moshe Rabbeinu and the angels appeared before Hashem. While the Romans, by the way, didn't feel any pain. The Mephoshim all say that when a person dies of Kiddush Hashem, he doesn't feel pain. But anyway, be that as it may. In fact, he didn't feel pain. He was talking to his students. They stood there while it was going on and said, Rebbe, how can you be so happy? Because he was saying Shema in ecstasy. So he said, all my life, there's one mitzvah that I haven't been able to do, which is to die for Hashem. And now I have the opportunity, I shouldn't be happy. That's what he said to them while they were busy doing that thing. But be that as it may, while he was dying, in Shamayim, Moshe Rabbeinu, listen carefully, Moses, and the angels appeared before Hashem. And they said to Hashem, Zu Torah v'zu Schara, this is Torah and this is its reward. And Hashem said to them the following words, Shtoik, be silent, Ki kach ola b'machshava, because this is what's come up in my mind. And if you ask one more question, I'll return the whole world back to void. And they weren't allowed to say anything else and they had to watch. You hear what's going on? Let's end with just the following idea. Where did this begin? We looked where it went to. That was Rabbi Eliezer, that's where it ended. But until the Mashiach. And it will all come back again when the two pathways will be apparent and will live. They'll blend into one and we'll live at the higher level. But in the end, where the two become one. Where did it begin? Just finish the next couple of minutes with the following idea. It began in the following way. You remember we said that this pathway of the students of Hillel and Shammai, let's trace it back. Where did they get it from? Hillel and Shammai. Where did they get it from? Trace ourselves 5 generations back till the generation of prophecy, remember? You can look it up in Birk Arbus if you forget. From there, it says, it went 5 generations back from the prophets, from the Anshei Knesset Sagdela, the men of the great assembly, to the prophets, to the elders, to Yoshua, Joshua, to Moses. Where did this come from? Moshe. What did he represent? What would you imagine Moshe Rabbeinu represented? Which of these two pathways, even if blended into one because he brought the whole Torah, but which was his personality a manifestation of? Obviously, the level of Shammah. Obviously, the level of Moshe Rabbeinu didn't need any excuses made for him. Moshe Rabbeinu was the one who held that perfection. Listen to what it says in Chazal. It says, Moshe Rabbeinu, because all of Moshe Lemorim, when Moshe went up to Shammayim, to heaven, to receive the Torah, yeah, he went into that transcendent dimension. You remember? He went up to Shemaim. He went to Har Sinai. And he went up into Shemaim for 40 days. He learned Torah with Hashem. Hashem was his Rebbe. Hashem taught him. He went up to Shemaim to receive the Torah. Listen to this incredible message. Now you have to switch on your Kabbalistic mind here to listen to these words. We're talking about a man living in Shemaim, living in heaven. We're talking about a man living in the transcendent world of oneness. So you cannot understand it like a child. It says he didn't sleep for 40 days and he didn't eat. Why didn't he sleep or eat and drink? Because the malachim in that world don't eat and drink, and Moshe conducted himself with derech eretz. The Gemara says when you're in a certain town, you should do the customs of that town. So he went to a place where nobody eats and drinks and sleeps, so for 40 days he didn't eat and sleep or drink. So he did, he respected the custom of the place, that's what it says. So there's Moshe Rabbeinu up in this transcendent level, living completely out of the level of being human. He arrives in front of Hashem, listen to this, again, don't use your, if you picture this, it's a terrible prohibition. Okay? Do not picture pictures. But listen with your inner mind to what's happening. He appears in front of Hashem, and the Medrash says that he found Hashem doing certain things. He found him tying the crowns to the tops of the letters. You know, in the Sefer Torah, the letters have little crowns above them. These are the crowns that teach the Kabbalistic connection to the higher world. The crown is always that which is above the thing, but which is its status, like a king. Above him is the crown. That is everything, but it's above his level. Yes? He saw Hashem connecting the crowns to the letters. It says many beautiful things. But one of the things that it says is the following thing. Unbelievable thing. Moshe ben Aras, and he hears Hashem learning Torah. Hashem is busy learning Torah. What does Hashem do? He does the mitzvahs that we do. You know that. We only do them in the Torah because Hashem does them himself. It says that everything we do, learn Torah, Hashem learns Torah. We do mitzvahs. Hashem does mitzvahs, except in our tefillin it says the greatness of Hashem. And in Hashem's tefillin it talks about the greatness of the Jewish people. That's what love is. But nevertheless, Hashem learns Torah and Hashem does the mitzvahs. So Moshe Rabbeinu arrives in front of Hashem, the creator of the world, and he stands silently while Hashem is learning Torah. He doesn't interrupt. The great Rebbe is learning Torah. And what's Hashem learning? Moshe Rabbeinu incredibly hears the following words. Hashem is learning the sugya, he's learning the Mishnah, that deals with the area of Parah Aduma. You know there's a Mishnah, you know that there's a section of Torah that deals with the red heifer. That's the one law that we can't understand. That law is so high that even King Solomon couldn't fathom it, because it's got certain inbuilt paradoxes that the human mind can't fathom. So Moshe Rabbeinu goes up, except Moshe understood it. Hashem taught it to him. He goes up and he hears Hashem learning the law of Parah, and what words come out of Hashem's mouth, Kiviyochu? Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Rabbi Eliezer says, and then follows the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, that a Parah Aduma must be 3 years old, 2 years old, whatever it is. You have to understand what's going on. We're talking Moshe Rabbeinu. Many, many generations before Rabbi Eliezer lived. Many generations before he lived, Hashem's quoting his words. First of all, it's a proof that Hashem learns Torah the way we learn it, not his opinion. Isn't that incredible? We just learned that Rabbi Eliezer held that the way it is in Shemaim is the way it really is. And how is it really in Shemaim? What Hashem's saying is the words of Rabbi Eliezer, not Rabbi Yeshua. Understand this. See, that was a little bit of Gemara, a little more excited. So Moshe Rabbeinu stands silently, and he hears Hashem saying the words of Rabbi Eliezer. Moshe Rabbeinu came from where? Where was he? Shurish Neshoma? It says in the Kabbalistic writings, on the left-hand side. There are conflicts with us, I'm not going to go into detail. But he was from the Shurish, the source of Rabbi Eliezer's source. So Moshe Rabbeinu was incredibly struck when he heard this, because he heard his own Neshoma speaking. Now listen to what happened. As he stands there and Hashem is learning, Hashem stops learning and he turns to Moshe, God himself, Kiviyoch, whatever this means. And he says, Moshe, klum ein shalom be'ircha. Which means, don't people say shalom where you come from? Why don't you greet me? Listen to this. Hashem says to Moshe, why don't you greet me? Klum ein shalom be'ircha. In your town, don't people say shalom? So Moshe stands thunderstruck and he says to Hashem, klum yesh eved, shematim shalom le'rabboi. Is there ever a servant who greets his Rebbe first? Hashem, in your Torah, the way you set up the world, you've taught that a servant must wait to be greeted by his master. He doesn't speak up first when his master is not ready. He waits to be greeted by his Rebbe. Good answer. What did Hashem mean? What did Hashem mean? What's going on here? What did Hashem mean when he asked Moshe a criticism? Why don't you greet me? Of course Moshe doesn't greet Hashem. If you were standing in front of the Kodesh Baruch Hu and he's busy learning Torah. When you walk up to Rosh Hashim in front of the Beis Midrash and he's busy learning a Mishnah, you butt in. You stand there until he notices you, which can be a half an hour, by the way, because he concentrates and notice anything. But Hashem over there. So listen to this incredible conversation. He says, don't people greet each other where you come from? Says Moshe. But Hashem, does a servant ever greet his Rebbe? Says Hashem to Moshe the following words, Hayo lecha nozreni, you should have helped me. Says God, says Hashem to Moshe Rabbeinu, I know that a servant doesn't greet his Rebbe first, but you should have helped me. What's going on? What's going on? Listen carefully. Listen carefully. The Medrash says this. Then we complete the Medrash and we'll try just in 2 minutes to explain it. When Moshe Rabbeinu heard that, and he heard Hashem, when he heard Hashem saying the words of Rebbe Eliezer, he burst out. Moshe Rabbeinu said the following thing. He hears God, he hears Hashem learning the Mishnah of Parah Aduma. That thing that no human can understand, but that Moshe got to understand. He hears Hashem learning it in the words of Rebbe Eliezer. As soon as he heard that, Moshe made a request to Hashem. He said the following thing. Yehi rotzon sheyetzei ze michalatzoi. May it be your will that that man should come out of my loins. In other words, you follow what's going on. He heard the opinion of Rebbe Eliezer, and he asked Hashem a favor that that man who is to be born in history should be born out of me, should be a son of mine. It says that what ties this whole medrash together is the fact that it says in Chazal Arizal speaks about this. He speaks in one or two words. One has to understand what he means. But it says that when Moshe was up there, Hashem showed him all the generations. He showed him all the future generations of Torah. He showed him Rabbi Akiva. He showed him Rabbi Eliezer. He showed him all future generations of how the Torah that he was receiving now as his trust, he would give it down to earth, and how it would spread itself through the generations. He showed him the pathways that Torah would take. So where did he show him Rebbe Eliezer? Where did he show him Rebbe Eliezer, that great man who would live many generations hence? Because he was saying the words of Rebbe Eliezer. Where did he show him Rebbe Akiva? Listen carefully, it's the most beautiful thing. Where did he? It says like this. When Moshe saw that Hashem was tying the crowns to the top of the letters, he said to Hashem, what are these? What are these little crowns? So Hashem said to him, there will come a man, listen to this, there will come a man in the future, from each little crown on top of the letter he will darshan, he will learn out piles and piles of halachas. So Moshe wanted to see this great man. So Hashem took him forward in time, and he placed him at the back row of a base medrash, in front of which was teaching who? Rebbe Akiva. This great man Rebbe Akiva was teaching, and from each little crown on top of the letters, he was teaching piles and piles of Torah, of halachas. And Moshe couldn't understand him. Moshe couldn't understand his depth. He couldn't understand what Rebbe Akiva was saying. This man was teaching of such depth, and Moshe, it says, his mind went weak. He was learning, he was listening to a man teaching the Torah that he had given. He had brought it to the world, and he couldn't understand. It says he had chushas adas, his mind began to go weak. Until eventually the students asked Rebbe Akiva a question and another, and finally, when Rebbe Akiva was down to the rock bottom, his answer was, Aloha la Moshe Mishinai. This thing is so because it was taught to us by Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai, and then he suddenly revived. What's going on? Moshe Rabbeinu, when exposed to the Torah of Rebbe Akiva, he had trouble understanding. What's one understanding of this? Which Torah was there? The Torah of Beis Hillel. The Torah of Beis Hillel. You follow? And Moshe was from the side of perfection. The side of the way it really is, like Rebbe Eliezer. So he needed to be shown the side of his Torah in Rebbe Akiva's Torah to understand it. But when he heard Rebbe Eliezer's voice, when he heard Hashem learning the Torah of Rebbe Eliezer, he said, Hashem, I want that man to be my son. And what does it say? He was. Because Moshe Rabbeinu had a son. One was called Gershom, and his second son was called Eliezer. His son was called Rebbe Eliezer. And the Arizal points out it was an incarnation that later became the soul of Rebbe Eliezer. He came out of Moshe Rabbeinu, because that was the side. One more detail we have to understand, which is amazing. Listen carefully. Listen very carefully. What did Moshe Rabbeinu know? What did he know for sure when he went up to Shemaim? He knew basically Shemaim. He knew the side of perfection, the way it really is, like where he was living. He knew that perfectly. When he heard Rebbe Eliezer's version, he knew exactly. He wanted that to be part of him. He knew that perfectly. That is why he didn't greet Hashem. Because at Shammai's level, you do what's right. At Shammai's level, you do what's right. At Beis Shammai's level, Hashem is right. Hashem is. And what Hashem is. And you stand there till you're spoken to. The reality that begins reality is Hashem's reality. And then it devolves to you. But what's Beis Hillel? What is Beis Hillel's opinion? Reality begins with us. And we build it up to Hashem's reality. And therefore, we should have greeted him first. You follow? He should have spoken first. Hayal Chalos reigning means you should have helped me. What's this thing of helping Hashem? That's Beis Hillel. Beis Shammai is, you don't help Hashem, you shape up. Hashem says, what Hashem says is, you match up. There are no two ways about it. You shape up, you batter yourself into shape. There's no holes, there's no forgiving. There's exacting justice, that's all there is. What does Beis Hillel teach? No. Beis Hillel brings the incredible idea to the Jewish people that we start the world with imperfection. The underlings begin, what's called Masha Tachtonim, the low beings, the finite beings, stuck in the earth. They begin reality and they build it up to Hashem's reality. According to Beis Shammai, when you appear in front of Hashem, you don't say a word. You wait till you greet it. According to Beis Hillel, you speak up first. Your job is to help Hashem. To help him, Kibir. You follow what's going on here? So he said to him the words, and of course Moshe Rabbeinu didn't greet. He was from the side of Beis Shammai. So of course he didn't, you follow, of course he didn't greet Hashem, he waited to be greeted, and Hashem taught him the incredible chiddush that there's a Beis Hillel in the world. You, Moshe Rabbeinu, from the Beis Shammai, that's the side you hold from. You hold, from that side, you hear Rebbe Eliezer, you want him to be of yours. You hear the side of Beis Shammai, I'm going to teach you something. I'm going to show you that out of you is going to come a man, out of you will come a man called Hillel. And Hillel will be the line where you speak up first and you help me. You know what the Arizal says about that meeting between Moshe and Hashem? It just says three words, that's all. But listen to the three words. Without this discussion tonight, it would have been meaningless. But after you had this discussion, we can understand. We'll finish with this. The Arizal, the great mystic, Rav Yitzchak Luria, the Ari, who lived in the late 1500s, a great, great man with Ruach HaKodesh, holy inspiration, the Kabbalistic, the leader of everything we have Kabbalistically. in his work, where he discusses the incarnations and how Moshe Rabbeinu up in that world saw all future generations. He wants to know, he doesn't say this, I'm just giving you the background, he wants to know, where did Moshe Rabbeinu see Hillel? We know where he saw Rabbi Akiva. Says clearly, Hashem showed him. Where did he see Rabbi Eliezer? He heard Hashem speaking Rabbi Eliezer. He saw everything. Where did he see Hillel? Where did he see Hillel? He saw Hillel where he was told that he should have greeted Hashem first. Says our Arizal, just three words. Haya lecha lozraini. You should have helped me. Roshe teivois, Hillel. Haya lecha lozraini. The three letters that spell the first letters of those three words are Hillel. Haya lecha lozraini. When Hashem said those three words, he was showing him Hillel, as it would appear in future generations.